Just before 9 o'clock last night, the jury returned guilty verdicts against all three defendants.
It was absolute shambles, to tell you the truth. Just absolutely ridiculous.
Had blood on his clothing the day after the alleged attack.
On a shallow mud bank in the Fitzroy River.
Basically, I think most of the people who used Tamiva are good people.
I think a really important question we need to ask is, how many Indigenous prisoners in Australia are innocent?
This is Curtain, a podcast where we pull back the blinds to shine a light on the darkest parts of our justice system and ask, who are the victims? I'm Amy McGuire.
And I'm Martin Hodgson, a senior advocate for the Foreign Prisoner Support Service. Our producer is Paul Watts, music by Clint Curtis, and produced in collaboration with the Brisbane Indigenous Media Association. And a warning, this series contains the names of deceased peoples and has distressing content that might upset some listeners.
Thank you for joining us for Curtain the Podcast. If you've been following regularly, you would know that we've been airing this investigation for the past 8 weeks. We've raised a great deal of doubt about the guilt of Kevin Henry, who has been in jail for a quarter of a century over the murder of an Aboriginal woman named Linda in September 1991. Now, for the last few episodes, we've been giving you a few details about the forensic evidence in this case.
That evidence is currently in the process of being reviewed by an international forensic expert. It could potentially be very important. And so, as we told you last week, we can't rush these things. But in the meantime, we want to tell you a little bit about the background to this case. If you're not from Australia, and even if you're not from Queensland, you may not have known what it was like for people living there in 1991.
When we tell you the details of this case, particularly regarding the police, you need to know the context in which this happened. It's vital to your understanding of this case. We told you previously that Kevin Henry was picked up the day Linda was found for public drunkenness. He was then thrown in the watch house with two other men that day. Now, many blackfellas in Australia would know this was not an unusual occurrence.
We told you about how Linda died in the same year the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody was handed down. Her brother was one of the most high-profile cases investigated by the Commission. At the time, the Commission came down heavily on the criminalisation of public drunkenness, taking in mind the fact many of the men and women who had died in custody had been locked up for simply being intoxicated in public.
We also told you about how people at Tanuba House would often use the place as a sanctuary to get away from police. Around the same time, the local Morning Bulletin newspaper would report on several outrages involving over-policing in the town, particularly when a 12-year-old boy was locked up with adults and thrown in the watch house overnight. It seems fair to say that Aboriginal mob at the time, just like the current day, had a strange relationship with police, and it wasn't just Aboriginal people. This tragedy occurred only a few years after the Fitzgerald inquiry was handed down, when public attention on police corruption in Queensland was at its highest point. But if you can imagine the wider public were concerned about police misconduct, imagine how Aboriginal people would have felt.
The Aboriginality of both the alleged perpetrators and the victim is vital to understanding this case. It is vital to understanding what we have told you so far. The police investigation into this case was deeply flawed. From the moment they entered the crime scene, it was left unsecured for hours. And from there, the problems just continued to pile up. Many of the witnesses were interviewed either while intoxicated, without legal representation, or both. Quite a number of the witnesses were illiterate and were unable to read the statements they'd allegedly given. They were also giving those statements under considerable duress. Many spoke about the pressures placed on them to provide multiple statements before the trial commenced. We also know that once the police had arrested Kevin Henry on the 5th of September, by their own admission, they ceased investigating the case any further. This is despite many issues coming up. The forensic evidence hadn't come back yet. A man allegedly confessed to his own solicitor who passed on this information, and many more questions that were raised over the coming months. There was also the deeply concerning issue that not only were the three women charged with murder on the same day, the 5th of September, as Kevin Henry, they were charged under different circumstances. And how could one murder take place in two different ways by two sets of people?
But to understand why this might have occurred in the police investigation and why it's perhaps not even surprising for the time, you also have to understand Queensland at the time. Even a couple of years after the Fitzgerald inquiry, which led to convictions for several police officers as well as the charging of several Queensland politicians, these concerns still continued.
Now, leading up to the Fitzgerald inquiry, there were two journalists in particular whose work was vital in pushing for change. One of those journalists was the Four Corners reporter, Chris Masters, and the other was the Courier Mail's Phil Dickey. Phil would go on to win the Gold Walkley, the highest honour in Australian journalism.
Now, Phil Dickey lives in Switzerland. Martin spoke to him earlier this week to give us a sense of what it was like to live in Queensland at this time and why police were the subject of so much mistrust.
Can you tell me a little bit about the series of reports in the Courier Mail that helped spark the Fitzgerald inquiry?
Yes, of course. I was asked to investigate the ownership of a sort of massage parlour at the top of the valley. And I took some liberties with that assignment and tried to find out who owned all of the massage parlours, tried to establish, you know, what actual business was going on there. It was, you know, clearly prostitution, which was clearly illegal. And then I detailed the people who were involved in a level of detail that hadn't been done before. And that sort of led to furore, and one thing led to another, and the detailing of the criminal figures and their links to particular police led to fairly clear inferences of corruption. Because of the legal system, we had to keep it at the level of inferences. But together with a outstanding ABC Four Corners report, it took the government to a place where that they had to call an inquiry.
And at the time when you were writing these articles, how widely known or suspected was it in the public that this level of corruption was going on?
Probably only some impression in the public, I think. Amongst journalists, it was fairly well believed that the police were quite corrupt. But, you know, despite numerous succession of stories over many years, that had never been cracked before. And I think the difference was that before the media would get a statement from someone alleging corruption, they'd repeat the statement, the government, the police would deny it, the person who made the complaint would find themselves out of a job or posted to Cunnamulla or something.
Right.
That would be the end of it. There'd be token efforts to set up police complaints tribunals and things like that, but these were operated in such a way that they never came to any result. And I think the difference that I made was I took it from an investigative point of view. So it was actually the Courier Mail making the allegations, not some vulnerable, you know, pissed off police officer or someone like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And clearly the work you did was so impactful that you won the Gold Walkley. I wonder what sort of pushback you had from the police and from political circles about what you were exposing.
Quite a lot, from, you know, threats of violence to a bullet hole in a related window. That's probably not surprising. I heard later about efforts to, you know, defame me or just annoy me and sort of say, okay, Dickie's obviously gay or something like that. That sort of thing's fairly typical. I think I think basically you have to ignore it. Sometimes you have to sort of say to someone, hey, are you threatening me? And that usually makes them back off a bit.
Yeah. And was that part of the culture, the political culture and police culture at the time in Queensland, sort of widespread?
I think you've got to get beyond the police force and look at Queensland overall. And I think probably the best term of describing how Queensland was run at the time was as a sort of a crony state. If you were in good with the governing powers and, you know, or the governing arrangements at all sorts of levels, from the state to the council, then, you know, then you would do well. And if you upset the apple cart, then, you know, steps would often be taken to marginalise you or get you to cease and desist.
And what links did you find, I guess, that you could explain to the general public who may not be aware at all of the Fitzgerald Inquiry between police and the absolute top level politicians and political circles in the state?
I think very, very early on, sort of myself and Chris Masters found ourselves operating not at the level of, you know, constables and detective sergeants, but we're operating at the level of assistant commissioners and very senior police. And then you've got obvious questions of, you know, these people have had question marks over their careers. Who's been promoting them? And so you've got a very direct link into the political circles there. But we also were operating in a background of, you know, frequent allegations of strange dealings politically that were close to verging on corruption. So, you know, it's all part of the picture, I think, in many ways, and I've done a bit of work outside of Australia now. So it's, in many ways, the police are the easy ones to catch at corruption because they deal with criminals, and criminals like to big note themselves, and, you know, there's always gossip on the streets, and there's a fairly high level of interest in the media and the salacious aspects of police work. So police are often the first to get caught out in a system which is, you know, fairly corrupted through and through.
And, I mean, through all the investigation work you've done, how would you say this culture of corruption from the top down started and was allowed to fester for so long?
Well, I did go into the history of it in a lot of detail. I think you can go back to colonial times and find, you know, with the treatment of Aboriginals, the native police, the way temperance movements, gambling, you know, early prostitution were governed, you can find roots back then. I think with the thread of corruption that was exposed in the Fitzgerald Inquiry, you've got a very clear link between the sudden growth of an illegal economy in the Second World War and the sort of the continuous growth of corruption to the level of the joke and the political corruption that Fitzgerald outlined. There was one significant effort to deal with it on the way through, but that failed. And in part it failed, I think, because it concentrated on the monetary aspect of corruption and not in terms of the corruption of police process. You know, the constant verballing to get quick convictions and things like that. So I think there's a... You have to tackle corruption as endemic and serious, you know, when you find it. And even then it's a very hard thing to root out, and I'm not sure that Queensland succeeded. It had an excellent opportunity post-Fitzgerald, but I don't think it succeeded, I'm afraid.
Yeah. And, I mean, based on all the work you've done and what you've seen take place since the inquiry, what would you say who were the big victims in Queensland of the corruption? Was it the most vulnerable people in society?
Look, I think we're all victims. And you can clearly outline some people who are particularly victimised. And I'd emphasise, you know, one of the most victimised groups was honest police. A lot of laws that are... that are hard to enforce and that are sort of more about enforcing morals than dealing with crime, you have this classic effect all over the world that the policing of those sorts of laws impacts on minorities or people who you know are outside the general stereotypes, and you're seeing that now, of course, with you know migration law around the world dealing with refugees. You know who is impacted. Not the people who arrive on aeroplanes and overstay visas, but the people who try and, you know, sort of swim or take leaky boats across national borders. So it's the most vulnerable who always suffer. I think there was a saying in Queensland that we managed to verify with research about cannabis law enforcement, which is, you know, the rich get stoned and the poor get busted.
Right.
And I think in Australia you see all of the numerous reports on Indigenous enforcement, the way Indigenous people are disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system and in the jails, in the courts, you know, more than their actual involvement in crime warrants.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for those who do know some of the Fitzgerald Inquiry and saw the Four Corners report, they'd know a lot about what happened in Brisbane and on the Gold Coast. But what about regional areas? How much did it affect regional Queensland?
Look, in some cases it was worse because you were dealing with smaller markets. The police and criminal partnerships were more of a factor in society. There were closer links to local government, for instance, in places like Cairns and the Gold Coast. The corrupting influences were much closer together and much, you know, sort of, it wasn't as remote as George Street. It was, you know, City Hall and the police station and the local clubs and nightclubs and the pubs. And so it could be more of a factor. And you could, away from the, you know, the scrutiny of bigger city institutions and newspapers and journalists, you could get you could get arrangements where people were really living in fear of their lives in small communities because they had fallen outside the system.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did see that myself a bit in places like Mareeba, for instance.
Right. One thing we've discovered in our investigation of the time and speaking to particularly the Aboriginal community in Rockhampton was a great level of fear of the police and of authority. I wonder if you discovered anything about Rockhampton in particular in your investigations.
The only thing I remember, there was an abortive attempt by one of the crime groups to set up a gambling casino in Rockhampton. So apart from that, I didn't go into too much detail there.
Right. Another issue that the inquiry raised was the issue of the way Aboriginal prisoners in particular were interrogated, and the issue of gratuitous concurrence, where they would often just give an answer most likely to please the questioner. And there were a lot of issues raised around whether that led to convictions. Was that something that you touched on in your investigation?
If I could go a bit broader than that, you know, I've done a lot of work with Indigenous people around the world now. And you will find that that's a common mode of communication. That you know, there is this real desire to, you know, to please and relate. So you will be told things that, from our perspective, are quite clearly untrue or unlikely. that they're not, you know, they're not being fed in that context. Or if you ask a question, you'll get an answer that is meant to please you, whether it actually resembles the actual state of what happened or what you're inquiring about. So, you know, that happens. Now, it's a matter of cultural sensitivity. Now, a well-conducted, well-run police force, which Queensland did not have in those days, would have had specialists on staff who would know some of these subtleties and who would, you know, sort of allow, and there'd be specific training. I think, you know, I hope that sort of thing happens now, but I think it was commonplace. It was commonplace sometimes just because of this, you know, quick and easy attitude to getting a conviction, shoving someone through the courts. And also because, you know, it could work. And because, you know, junior police follow the example of more senior police, and if they're not specifically instructed that this is a particular issue with a particular population, then they don't take account of it. Courts, you know, there's also a role for courts to question this too, and to be aware of this. So I think you've got a general failure occurring frequently in Queensland.
Yeah, and just finally, before we came on air, we spoke how you've lived away from Australia for around a decade now and seen the way other court systems operate. I was just wondering if you could explain to the listeners what you've observed and mainly the positives and negatives of the two systems.
Well, I think, there is, in theory, a presumption of innocence in the British judicial system that most of the Anglo countries around the world have adopted. But there's also elements of old medieval trial by combat resolution of disputes and getting it at guilt or innocence. And if you don't, you can't afford, or you're marginalised, then you don't get the champion in the court, and you can suffer thereby. I think in the alternative tradition of European systems, the Code Napoleon system, you know, there's more of a structure where the judiciary is involved from the start in investigation, and the obligation of parties before the court is to assist in getting at the truth of the matter. Now, both systems can be corrupted, and you can get outcomes that are incorrect and less than desirable in both systems. But you know, they're the advantages and drawbacks. The ironic thing in Queensland, I guess, is the Fitzgerald Inquiry inquiries generally are things conducted under the European type system. You're trying to get a truth of the matter, and you uncover things that would never come out in courts of law. You know, there's more ways of ruling evidence inadmissible, and declining to take into account things that might seem extraneous but are actually vital to explanation.
Thank you so much for that explanation and for your expertise on this area.
Okay, Martin, we just heard from Phil Dickey, who we told our listeners was the journalist who helped spark the Fitzgerald Inquiry. What do you take from that? Do you think it gives a good sense of what Queensland was like, maybe when Kevin was first arrested?
Well, I think it puts things in perspective. I think we have to always remember what Phil said as we talk about this case, and when we think about this case, that the way Queensland was run, both politically and the way police operated, was not what most people are used to nor understand. There was a high level of corruption, there was no oversight, and there were huge issues with the way the place was run. And I think that for most people looking at the case won't really appreciate that, and I think it's really important to keep it in mind.
The Fitzgerald Inquiry was handed down in the late 80s, so a few years before this happened, but Do you get a sense that, particularly in regional Australia, it might have still been sort of the... It hadn't really been resolved at that time. Not all, it hadn't had enough time to change this sort of environment?
Yeah, certainly. I think we can take from what Phil said that he still has concerns that things haven't changed even to this day. So certainly just a few years later in a regional town like Rockhampton, the same police were still working, same lack of oversight still existed, and the same tactics of operating were still in existence. And I think that we have to question whether things have changed at all in this way. We still see the exact same problems that were raised in the Fitzgerald Inquiry occurring to this day. So while many of the political issues may have been resolved, I don't think the policing issues were.
Particularly, I guess it explains maybe a lot of the... how, if the wider Queensland viewed police that way, and in fact the whole nation viewed Queensland police that way, imagine how Aboriginal people and the Aboriginal community in Rockhampton must have viewed police at that time. It was obvious that there must have been tension between the two groups, do you think?
Well, absolutely, and I think there was also a great level of distrust and fear. I think that's clear from the report handed down that the way Queensland was run was a corrupt state. And any time a state is run and is corrupt from the very top, as it was, that those who are most vulnerable are at the most risk. So I think for Aboriginal people in particular, and those in lower socioeconomic circumstances, that the fear that would have existed, the distrust that would have existed, would have been enormous. And I think that reflects on why many people didn't report crimes that were committed against themselves, as well as the way people were policed.
It's interesting you say that, because I guess a lot of listeners would be thinking, why didn't anyone call police when Linda was assaulted the first time? And maybe that distrust of police and that fear of police could have bled into that reluctance to call police, do you think?
I think that's absolutely right, and I think we have to remember that at the same time as this was occurring, we'd just seen the Royal Commission into Black Deaths in Custody, where we still know 25 years after that's finished, we have nearly 400 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have died at the hands of police and corrective services. So at the time, we had both this level of corruption in police and at a political level, and violence by police and corrective services. So why would anyone in the Aboriginal community call the police for help when their most likely way of dying, being assaulted and injured, was at the very hands of people they were being asked to call? So I think the level of fear definitely played into that. And I think the whole issue surrounding Black Deaths in Custody, surrounding corrupt police behaviour, violence by the police, intimidation, threats, I mean, these are just not allegations. These are things that were raised and proven in both Royal Commissions and, well, one Royal Commission and the Fitzgerald Inquiry. So, I mean, this was systemic in Queensland and right across Australia, and I think we need to consider that when we listen to what happened on that day at Tanuba House.
And, yeah, it's very interesting you said that it was raised particularly in the Fitzgerald Inquiry, and it did have occasions where it brought up the police handling of Aboriginal witnesses. So I think in the Fitzgerald Inquiry there was a section where it talked about gratuitous concurrence and how some police actually use that to an advantage. And it seems like the case in Kevin's confession, when you read comments like that from the Fitzgerald Inquiry, you sort of see it line up with what might have happened with Kevin's confession, which we've already discussed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can see in the way Kevin's confession took place, the fact that it was done without legal representation, the way the questions were asked and the yes or no answers that were given, this was exactly the sort of interview that the Fitzgerald Inquiry warned against. and warned against because it had led to so many statements that were factually incorrect. Clearly, it led to the arrest and conviction of innocent people. Clearly, it led to statements that weren't at all based on the truth. It was just about pleasing the officers involved and getting the version of events they wanted and suited their story. So I think it's fair to say that the Fitzgerald inquiry in that sense as well had definitely not filtered down to Rockhampton at the time. And we have to have grave concerns about the way that that interview was conducted. And the fact that the issues surrounding the way it was conducted had been raised at the highest levels in the state, and yet just years later, it was still going on. So Queensland Police had definitely not learnt a lot from the Fitzgerald inquiry vis-a-vis dealing with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in an appropriate manner.
So going forward in this podcast series, it's important to remember the words of Phil Dickey, the Courier-Mail reporter whose journalism helped spark the Fitzgerald inquiry.
And we must also remember at the time the recently finished Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. The inquiry, the Royal Commission and the corrupt nature of the way Queensland was run at the time, both at a political level and a police level, play a crucial role in the trial and conviction of Kevin Henry.
That was episode 8 of Curtain, a podcast delving into the 1991 murder of an Aboriginal woman named Linda on the banks of Toonooba or the Fitzroy River in Rockhampton, Central Queensland. For now, you can catch up on iTunes by typing in Curtain the Podcast or go to our website, www.curtainthepodcast.com.
Also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Curtain the Podcast.